The Bible and Modern Science with your host, Dr. Joseph Henson of the Science Faculty of Bob Jones University. Here is Dr. Henson.
Thank you. We've been looking at statements by evolutionists honestly dealing with the difficulty of the missing species, intermediate species, common ancestors, etc. And on our last program, we had looked at a comment from Luther Sunderland's book entitled Darwin's Enigma, in which two curators of museums that contain tens, if not hundreds of thousands of fossils, admitting candidly that they are unaware of any intermediate species, either living or in fossils. I want to go to another section of Mr. Sunderland's book, and there is a discussion here that I think you would find very interesting. This is found on page 65 of Darwin's Enigma. It's a section entitled Amphibian to Reptile. Is the picture any different regarding the first appearance of reptiles in the fossil record? When Dr. Eldridge was asked about the supposed amphibian to reptile transition, he replied that some taxonomists say there is no such thing as a reptile. Dr. Eldridge continued, and in respect to amphibians, some biologists say there is no such thing as an amphibian either. Thus, a frog is not an amphibian, but either a fish or a reptile. He said, quote, well, the reptiles are not a natural group because some are more closely related to birds and some are more closely related to mammals, end quote. Now, I'm not going to stop here to respond to the comment, but if it is taken at face value, it makes an absolute shambles of the attempt to classify organisms. That is all he had to offer, so he sidestepped the question by suggesting in the third person that there was no such thing as a reptile. In other words, according to this contention, reptiles such as alligators, snakes, turtles, Tyrannosaurus rex, and Brontosaurus should all be called birds or mammals. It is highly unlikely that a prominent scientist such as Dr. Eldridge would make such meaningless statements if there were any actual fossils connecting amphibians and reptiles. This is Mr. Sunderland's observation about Dr. Eldridge's comments. Neither Dr. Patterson nor Dr. Raup could offer a single transitional form between any of the major groups of animals. And then he goes on with a discussion about that. I hope you find their statements enlightening and interesting, because they're not the kind of thing that you're going to see presented on PBS programs, and it's certainly not the kind of thing that you're going to find printed in most biology texts. Now, there's one other section in the book that I think contains an idea. It is part of a letter which Dr. Patterson wrote to Mr. Sunderland on 10 April 1979. I want to read Mr. Sunderland's comments and then Dr. Patterson's letter. Page 89. Before interviewing Dr. Patterson, the author read his book, Evolution, which he had written for the British Museum of Natural History. In it, he had solicited comments from readers about the book's contents, and a letter was written to Dr. Patterson asking why he did not put a single photograph of a transitional fossil in his book. On 10 April 1979, he replied to the author in the most candid letter as follows. Now, this is the letter. I fully agree with your comments on the lack of direct illustration of evolutionary transitions in my book. Now, listen carefully to the next sentence. If I knew of any fossil or living, I would certainly have included them. You suggest that an artist should be used to visualize such transformations, but where would he get the information from? Now, let me stop here for a moment. There are some books you can go to, and you will see there, in some cases in living color, pictures of so-called intermediate species, but they are purely and simply mental constructs. They are drawn from imagination, as Dr. Patterson is indicating here. There is not, if you don't have the fossils, then you don't have any basis to start drawing pictures of them except as a matter of your own imagination. You suggest that an artist should be used to visualize such transformations, but where would he get the information from? I could not honestly provide it. And if I were to leave it to artistic license, would that not mislead the reader? And he's exactly right about that. There are presentations in many of our natural museums, that convey an information as though this were actual scientific evidence, and in fact, it is much of it is mental construct. It has not occurred because of actual material itself, and we'll talk a bit about that when we get to fossils. Let's continue with his letter. I wrote the text of my book 4 years ago. That would have meant in 1975. If I were to write it now, I think the book would be rather different. Gradualism is a concept I believe in, not just because of Darwin's authority, but because my understanding of genetics seems to demand it. Yet Gould and the American Museum people are hard to contradict when they say there are no transitional fossils. As a paleontologist myself, I am much occupied with the philosophical problems of identifying ancestral forms in the fossil record. You say that I should at least show a photo of the fossil from which each type of organism was derived. I will lay it on the line. There is not one such fossil for which one could make an airtight argument. Now, again, I hope the import of what Dr. Patterson is stating here occurs to you. Here he's writing a book about the fossil collection at the British Museum of Natural History. These things were not put in the book, and those who had read the book were taking him to task about it, and his answer was simply, there is not such a fossil, not one. Back to the letter. The reason is that the statements about ancestry and descent are not applicable in the fossil record. That is, which is the ancestor and which is the descendant. And he's saying this is simply not something that can be dealt with in the fossil record. And for anyone that is knowledgeable about fossils, I would expect that to raise some feathers. Is the Archaeopteryx the ancestor of all birds? Perhaps yes, perhaps no. There is no way of answering the question. It is easy enough to make up stories of how one form gave rise to another and to find reasons why the stages should be favored by natural selection. But such stories are not part of science, for there is no way of putting them to the test. Now, there are many other comments in the book. Perhaps those of you who are creationists will understand my enthusiasm for the book. But he has presented information and quotes from trustworthy evolutionary sources that certainly, in my opinion, are quite honest. I appreciate the candor of these men, but they're not the kind of thing that you're going to see usually presented in evolutionary videos, articles, cartoons, textbooks, etc. Now, I believe the first of these quotes I gave before, but I think it's pertinent here. In Stephen Jay Gould's book, an article entitled Evolution's Erratic Pace that was published in Natural History, May of 1977. On page 14 in that article, Stephen Gould made the following comment, quote, the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. Paleontologists have paid an exorbitant price for Darwin's argument. We fancy ourselves as the only true students of life's history, yet to preserve our favorite account of evolution by natural selection, we view our data as so bad that we never see the process we profess to study. Now, these are some telling comments also. Now, Gould's purpose, of course, in making these comments was not to help creationists. His purpose was simply to provide evidence for the punctuated equilibria, the theory that he came up with. Now, there was another article that he published in Natural History entitled The Return of Hopeful Monsters. Now, the hopeful monster name came from an idea that Dr. Simpson had in one of his articles, that here were organisms sitting around that in a particular environment were not especially suited to that environment, but they were simply sitting there waiting for an environment to appear in which they would be favored in some regard. And he referred to these kinds of things as hopeful monsters, and that's the basis of Dr. Gould's title here. The Return of Hopeful Monsters, Natural Selection, June-July of 1977. On page 22, made this comment, quote, "The fossil record, with its abrupt transitions, offers no support for gradual change." Now, let me read that again. "The fossil record, with its abrupt transitions, offers no support for gradual change, and the principle of natural selection does not require it. Selection can operate rapidly." Now, that is a comment with which many evolutionary biologists would take great issue. That is not the point of our discussing it here. On page 24, in that same article, he made this comment. "All paleontologists know that the fossil record contains precious little in the way of intermediate forms. Transitions between groups are characteristically abrupt." So here you have a dedicated evolutionist who is simply observing, not as an aid for creationism, but simply observing the nature of the evidence as it occurs in the fossil record. He's doing this, of course, to try and pump up support for his own particular theory. But he is simply honestly and legitimately making the observations that the kinds of things that are so critical to the evolutionary theory are exactly the kinds of things that are not found there. Now, this was something Darwin was knowledgeable about. In fact, he made a comment, I believe, in Origin of the Species. He said, "This problem of intermediate species or missing links, some people will look on as such a great problem that it overthrows my whole theory." And I would be inclined to agree with him about that. But his response to that was, well, we just have an incomplete fossil record. We haven't discovered enough in the fossil record yet to be the basis of all the organisms that are here. And as we continue to study and dig and find new things, we will find these missing links. Now, the interesting thing is that the things were missing in Darwin's day are still missing today. And the gap between one organism and another, the gap in Darwin's day, are wider today, not narrower. And I think the answer is very simple. It's just that evolutionists are looking around for something that doesn't exist, and this is likely to be very difficult to find.
Thank you, Dr. Henson. You may send email to Dr. Henson at jhenson@bju.edu. That's jhenson@bju.edu. Or write to Dr. Joseph L. Henson, Box 34621, Bob Jones University, Greenville, South Carolina, zip code 29614, in the United States of America. You're invited to listen next time for The Bible and Modern Science.